Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Dames of the Needle, Elizabeth Tayeto. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, guys.
Good to have you with us. All right, now, we've got a problem because you do everything. So we have to,
we have to
sort this out. So we've got some needlework design. We have dyeing. We have finishing. And you're adept in a wood shop, so you can make a box every now and then if we need one. So obviously a creative family. Learn from your grandmother, mother. How did that get started?
I've learned from my grandmother. My grandmother grew up during the wars, and she was German, first generation. And actually, she wasn't. She was born in Germany and came over here. My mom was first generation. But anyway, she made everything. She would buy dolls and made the clothing for my aunt and my mom. And my mom was like, I don't want any handmade anything. So it's gifted generation. My grandmother taught me how to do hand couture and embroidery. And we talked a little bit before, but I just said that my dad is a cabinet maker by family trade, and so is my grandfather. So I learned in their woodworking shop, and I had to train in there, and I had to make a Queen Anne's leg on a lathe and do dovetails. We made colonial furniture. So I just did it all. I mean, our family, like we just read about it and just do it.
But even through that, cause your mother's one of those, sounds like one of those classical, the kid rebels from the parent thing. You know, I grew up doing this. I want nothing more to do with it. But for you, it seems like no matter what it is, there's a creative drive in you that that carries through everything.
It does, and it comes a lot from my dad. My dad was like, I love him. He's great, and I got a lot of things from him. But he was like Captain Bly. He would decide we were going to do something, and the whole family did it. We didn't have a choice. And during the moments, I was a little... it was like, I don't really want to do this. I didn't realize all the skills and stuff I had accumulated. It was just a forced thing. It's like one time my dad, my parents were normal people that were hippies. They had normal jobs. We didn't live in a commune, but they were very young when they had me. And I sort of raised them in a weird way too. But my dad decided one time after going to a Grateful Dead concert that we should tie-dye. We didn't normal tie-dye. He came up with these wood blocks where he could fold a t-shirt up and you could make a flag out of it when we dyed it, an American flag. So and we look like a sweatshop doing it. We set it up in our kitchen and did it. And it wasn't really like fun, you know, like let's go buy a tie-dye kit. It was like this thing we did. And it was, you know, he would work shift work. So we would have 3 days off. Now he'd work 7 days, 3 days off, one day, 7-1, 7-5. And on his 5 days off or when we would do these things like the tie-dyeing and stuff like that. And we never knew, like we had motorcycles and he had boats. So we just did it. And I now realize what I experienced when I was young. But during the moment, it was, okay, Dad wants to do this, so we're doing it.
Well, you have a healthy background to draw from.
Yeah, I do. And him being a perfectionist made it even harder. I'm harder on myself than I am on other people. So some people think that I can be rough, but it's like, no, you should see what I'm doing to myself on the inside. I beat myself up, but I just, you know, if I don't make it the first time, I just keep going. And I like making lemonade out of lemons. If you make a mistake, you just make it into something else.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So what makes you stick with needlework instead of woodwork or something else?
Well, the interesting thing is I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts and I did it in photography and painting. And then my parents were like, oh, get a real job. So I hunted around for that for a while and I did IT. So I avoided textiles in university. I don't know. Well, most of it was because it was a lot of looms and things like that, and that didn't interest me. So I looked for the real job and then moved to Atlanta, and I got hooked up with people that were stitching, because when I was growing up, you didn't have these stitching stores. You would go to Belk's or places and buy kits and do that and buy bits and odds pieces, and I just did it on my own. And I found these people that were into samplers, which spoke to me because I grew up and went near Williamsburg, and colonial things speak to me and old things speak to me. So I just got hooked up with them and started doing the stitching, and it was easier. It's more portable. I mean, I have some woodworking tools, but you know, you can do stitching easier than you can woodworking. And so it just, my first class I'd ever taken in my entire life was a Darlene Osteen. I don't know how much you know of her, but she was a wonderful teacher, but she was always, well, this is the first time she taught the class, and it was a 4-day 17th century reversible stitching. And it wasn't finished. Like, she was notorious about that. And so my first class was that. And the first day I took the class, I stitched too close to the corner. So I sat up all night restitching what we did in class so I could keep going. And then the second day we learned double running, and she wanted us to just number it and then come back with the chart numbered so we could stitch it the next day. Well, I got it. So I stitched it and came with it stitched, and she got upset. I had stitched it. And she was like, "That's not what I told you to do." And I was like, "Well, I didn't see why I should number it if I understand it."
Right.
She and I laughed about it. We became friends after, you know, I sent her a note saying that was the worst class and the best class I ever had. And if I hadn't finished that piece, I would never stitch again. So I literally stitched on that thing every single day until I finished it. But after that, I figured I could do anything when it came to needlework. So.
So, all right, let's back up just a second. Your first class was a 17th century reversible stitched sampler?
Yes, sir, it was.
Okay, my hat's off to you. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't do anything half-ass. I'm sorry, I don't have to say that. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, I jump in, yeah.
Wow, okay. All right. You get it. So when do you start your business? Is your first effort designing, or?
Yeah, it was. Edna Medlin was a friend of a family friend. She owned Threads of Gold, and she did some distributing, and she knew me. I used to go through and go to her shop, and she had. There's a lot of people in Georgia that design, and a few of them she represented, and the most of them did reproduction samplers. And Edna Medlin kept talking to me and saying, you know, you always just change everything up. Why don't you design? And why don't you, and you're from that area. And so I fought it off for a bit. And finally, when my children are in vitro, and when I had my first daughter, I quit working. And so she's like, you've got some time on your hands, so why don't you design some things? I'll take them to market. And I just designed a few things, and it just kept growing. It wasn't anything I purposely started to do. I just did it because someone said to do it, and I had good mentors. I asked questions. People sort of told me what they did, and I taught myself publisher, got cross-stitched software, played with it and tried to imitate what other people did, and just kept doing it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So the designing, did you have stuff you just played with, of your own work, and then people wanted to buy it, or how did that work?
Yeah. I mean, Edna was not the great, I mean, Edna did a lot of reproduction, so a lot of my stuff didn't sell as well with her. I got picked up by Norden. Well, I was playing around with it on my own, and I really wasn't, I was into it, but not. And I was scared to go to shows, so people weren't really seeing what I was doing. And then I guess I'll step ahead on some of the questions, because this is where I became Dames of the Needle. After 9/11, a friend of mine, Lori Vermillion, and I went to lecture in Charleston, South Carolina. And on the way, we talked about wanting to design and everything. So we threw a bunch of things together, came up with a box, a limited edition box. I painted the box, and she and I were great. I was really sorry when she decided she needed to keep doing her real job, because we could talk on the phone and come up with these things like we'd been in a room together. But we tried to get into the needlework market and couldn't. And Marianne Mongolo from A Female Worth let us go in her booth, because we got a teaching class but didn't get a booth. So she let us share her booth or her room with her, because it was in Nashville. And within an hour, we had sold out of everything we brought. We had two contracts to do exclusive boxes for two shops. And we had, this is when Fine Lines was still around, we had an article we were going to do for them. And we were like, Marianne was like, why don't you guys go have some breakfast and think about this? Because we were overwhelmed. And then we had people tell us that. So they go, why don't you go talk to Chris at Norton Craft and get a distributor? So we went down to Norton Craft, and we were told that they don't accept new people at market. So we were like, oh, okay, we'll try again. So we went back upstairs and took some orders and did that. And we're trying to figure out what we were going to do, because we just were like, we weren't expecting this.
Yeah.
So a little bit later, Chris's son, Matt, came up and said, could you come down to Norton Craft? And we were like, well, we've already been there. And we were, you know, we'll talk to you later. And Matt goes, no, you need to come down now. And we were like, well, okay. So we went down, and Chris came out, and she goes, we need to go to the back room. And she told them, you know, don't disturb us. And so, and we were asked to bring some of our things, and we went in, and Chris goes, I've never, ever done this before, but I had at least seven people, you know, designers come by and tell me that I would be the stupidest person on earth if I didn't pick you guys up. And I know I'm not the stupidest person on earth. So I'm going to do something I've never done. And that's pick up designers at the show, even before the end of the show. Because this was all the first day of the show.
Oh,
and so,
man,
we were like, whoa. So she had a contract there and everything. So, yeah, we signed a contract at the show. And she picked us up. And
you talk about jumping into the deep end. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky. I mean, it's interesting. I've never really liked to say who I am. I always just show up at places. I've been very lucky and had been blessed with some very, very important people. Like, it's funny because I know Barb and Alma from Blackbird Design, and they actually bought from me before I bought from them.
Oh.
Cause I did hand painted needlepoint, and Alma came down. Her dad used to do fly fishing, and I had some needlepoint flies that I had hand painted, and she bought canvases for me before I had ever bought from them. So it's always a joke between us that even though they were like everybody bows down to them, that they bought from me before I bought from them. And then Barb loved my daughter, because my daughter's a sound engineer, and so she would talk to her about music and sound. So we always had a special relationship with them and some other people. So, yeah.
Cause that's the other part I noticed. Painted canvas and cross stitch design. What all design work do you do?
I just do it all. I did do some rug hooking. I did have some kits. It's just so hard to find wool and things. And I just keep paring back. You know, I leap into things. I do them. I take classes. Linen is my first love. I like needlepoint. what a lot of people don't understand is you can do almost all of the same stitches on both mediums. People try to tell you you can't, but you can. I'm really a frustrated needle pointer on linen because I like doing texture that you can't see. I love doing all these wonderful stitches on tiny linen
Right.
that you have to really look at it to see the texture. So,
Right.
Linen is really my main thing. And dyeing and all of that has taken over. But my true love is doing linen.
Yeah. So when I look at your design work, your cross stitch is a primitive. It looks like a more primitive bent to the design. Is that where you where you're most comfortable?
It tends to come out. I figured out that I'm a niche person and I like to be incognito. I sometimes am my own worst enemy. I limit myself. I like modern stuff, but I just, because of my colonial background and growing up with that, I go towards that. And lots of my things just, sometimes it's a dream or it just happens, you know, I just wake up that day and that's what I'm supposed to do. It just happens that way. Old things speak to me. So the primitive and the colonial type of feel it's more comfortable because that's where I grew up. And I'm being a Virginian, this is old school Virginians were taught that there's God, then you had the universe, then there's England, then there was Virginia, then the rest of the world sort of happened. So
okay.
I sort of learned it that way. I mean, so I stick to my roots.
Yeah, yeah. Because as I even saw that in your painted canvas, there's a primitive look to that too. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I don't do the stitch by stitch. It's got a flow. Yeah. And I think that comes from my painting and some of my other instructions. And I really think it comes from self-taught too, because I don't go by the rules. A lot of people, they would take like not having classes and then I already knew how to do things. And then it sort of reined me in. I just, you know, like I said, I will read it and I'll get the enough information to be dangerous. And then I just leap off and start doing. So
figure it out after that. Huh? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, love of linen then leads you to dyeing linen.
Yes and no. I was sort of asked to do it to get certain colors, and they knew that I was already dyeing trim, and I was asked if I would consider dyeing linen. And again, like the trim, when I was asked, I said no several times and then finally went, okay, I'll just do it. And again, it was self-taught. It was just off my knowledge of having taken some wool working classes and dyed wool and reading. And like, I don't use the package as it comes. I make my own recipes. I think of a color in my head and then try to figure out how to achieve it. And it's like magic. I look at dyeing as chemistry and art in motion. It's just the most exciting thing for me to think these things just pop. I don't know if I have an angel or what, but it just pops in my head. And then about 90% of the time I mix the things together and get what's in my head to happen. And that's, I really get frustrated because I'm in my little studio by myself and there isn't anyone there to see that this magic happens. Cause it really is. It's just, it is magical.
And now these days, getting dyed linen is a challenge on several fronts. I assume you're experiencing the same thing. Getting the base fabric is hard to get, and getting dye materials is difficult at times, and kind of an ongoing battle.
It is, and I tend to see trends. Like, it started getting hard even before the pandemic because a lot of our stuff is tied up coming from England, Europe and stuff. And when England said they were going to pull out of the UK, things started tightening up at that point. And I started seeing some things between China and Taiwan, because a lot of my my trim and stuff comes from over there. So I started seeing some blips even before we hit the pandemic. And I was totally not prepared for the pandemic. I tend to buy and die on orders, because it's not my total money. I mean, it makes money, but I do so many other things that I'm not concentrated on that and didn't have a huge stock of it. So I was way behind the curve on that.
No.
But trim has been hard because China was stopping doing some trading. So Taiwan picked up a lot of things, and like trim goes by what you do in the fashion industry. So it's not standard. So I've had to hunt and peck and find people to buy trim, because it's like buying from Guido on the corner. They don't let people in like me to buy. They really want a big buyer instead of a little person. So I've been fighting it before the pandemic, and then with the pandemic, it's just been a nightmare. Because I mean, like right now, there's chemicals that I don't know. I haven't researched it enough to know if they're not being made, or we ran out of them, out of the substance. But grays, blacks, and blues, the stabilizer for that is no longer being made. So dye industry has had to come up with a substitute, and they are reformulating their dyes, which is affecting me. And then there's some that are no longer available ever. They feel like they're extinct. And I don't know the whole whole story on it. I've been, you know, asking some, but I've just been so busy trying to reformulate and catch up and be one step ahead that I don't know everything.
You guys that die, you got your own business here in the States, but you actually become connected globally just to be able to do business. It's fascinating, but it's got to be incredibly frustrating chasing all over the globe for materials.
It is. And you don't want to be political, but unfortunately you have to. You have to watch what's going on, because that can affect how you're getting your items. So you have to watch that. And like shipping is a total nightmare too.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you have to use a third party to go into Australia and to parts of the UK. And then what people don't understand is we have a free market and can sell to whoever. Like Germany, you have to have a license, and they only allow so many licenses to each country to sell, like at the linen. And that's why that's getting, besides the fact that it's only a couple people making it now, only certain people can import it. You can't just contact them. So you have to go through the distributor here. So you have to be aware of who's buying whom and who has the license and that type of thing. It's very frustrating, and it's hard because you can't just go get it yourself. You have to go through third parties and figure out what's going on. And it takes a lot of time doing that too.
Yeah. Nice. Now the trim materials, the rickrack and those kinds of things, you dye those to complement your linens, or is that just a separate dye run of whatever is called for or whatever you feel like?
It started off because the trims were first, and I don't like to be my only dog and pony show. I get in trouble with my distributor a lot because they tell me I don't use enough of my own product. And I'm like, well, I don't make it for me. I make it for other people, because I just don't like tooting my own horn a lot. I want this industry to keep going, and I just love sharing and I love giving information. So I make things for other people to use, and I try to use my stuff. So the trims were, I tried to look at some trends and see what people were doing. So a lot of my first trim colors were brighter colors than I would normally go for. And then when I first introduced the linen, they were separate colors from my trim because I thought I would keep them separate. And then I added the velvet on because I saw a couple people were doing it and thought, oh, this would be fun and cool. So I found velvet and started doing that. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me that I could have the same color, but the materials take it differently. But I'll use the same recipe on different fabrics and found that I could do that. You know, so I did. So it sort of morphed into that. I do have people ask me to make a color, and I do that. And then I see what people are doing and see what other designers, but I don't like to watch too many people. I don't want them to influence me. So I just.
Yeah. No, I understand that. Yeah. I understand that. Yep.
It just sort of, like I said, it just is weird. It just like, I have a thing that goes off in my head, or I see something that strikes me and I'm going, I'm going to try that. Or that looks like an interesting thing. And truly a lot of the colors I do, I wouldn't stitch on them. They're not me, but I do it because I know it fits a need for other people. Like I have stitched on it just to promote it, but like my Peddler's Blend, I do that as an homage to Teresa from Shakespeare's Peddler. She's a very good friend of mine, and she was telling me some cool things she was doing, and she's like, why don't you take this and play with it? So I did, and that's how Peddler's Blend came about, and I named it after her because she, you know, told me some things she was playing with.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I think Beth wants like 2 yards of your velvet.
She can have it. To me,
I'm looking at that. That velvet just looks like it would be so much fun for people who are, because wool applique is gaining in popularity again, mm-hmm. and to add the velvet applique, so you've got the different textures, and I think you can emboss on, I've never tried this, but I think you can emboss on the velvet, which intrigues me.
Yeah,
it just seems like it would be a fun material to play with, and the colors you're making, they have a depth to them, which intrigues me. I hate them when they're just like flat, you know, just
yeah,
like and what you can I, get it. Yeah,
yeah. People, I call it more primitive dyeing. I don't want my stuff to look manufactured. It's like, if you want that, then go buy it. That's why I like depth and I guess muddiness and that type of thing. Some people don't. I have some people that will like not want a piece or of a cut of something because it's got multi layers on it. But that's, yeah, you're right. You're on the right track.
If it's just flat, yeah, you could go to any store and pick that up. I'd like to see the depth of color, and then that adds to what you're already doing. And I know a lot of people use those for the back of material, you know, for backing something, but I'm thinking of adding it, you know, to the front of something, and I want more depth. But
I do too. And that's why I try not to control. It's hard to get it sometimes in like water. The water, even if you filtered it, it would be an issue too. But what's in the water and sometimes how they've processed it, because I've noticed with this linen now, I know they're really struggling to keep up with what we want. And I've even noticed it with almost all my materials, how they've put it together is not how it's not as normalized as it was before. And it doesn't take the dyes the same way. And also the formulations of the dyes have changed. So sometimes I'm getting a more flat color when I don't want it, but I can't control that. And I think it's because a lot of it is there's too much chlorine and there's too much other things in our water just to extend things. I've been noticing a difference, and I notice different times of year things take better to others, but even in the same bolt of linen or velvet, in the same vats of dyes, I can get different changes in the dyes. So that's really a rough thing that you have to work with. And another thing that people, that you get hot spots. I'm not sure if any dyers have talked to you about that, but when they make, formulate dyes, the powders for the dyes, they put in what's called fillers, which is just leftover dye. And red molecules are the largest molecule and they're hard to dissolve. And then they've got blue and then yellow. So sometimes when, if you do not mix your colors right and beat them up and get them totally melted down or whatever you do to get them into what they need to be a dye, you can get the hot spots. And that also can work on getting the depth of the color too, that it's how it works. So you'll get spots like of red, just
right,
molecules that will grab and they won't go away, if I'm making sense.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I've had that happen when I've dyed, and it, you know, you think you've mixed it really well and you think you're ready, and then you get all the way to the end of the process and you're like, oh, I have dots. And you know, for me, it's just me personally dyeing so I can work with it. But if you're doing manufacturing dyeing like what you're doing, that must be a terrible pain. And especially since they're changing the formulas of the dyes, it must make it much more difficult.
It is. It's harder and harder. I'm lucky because that's why with the Etsy shop, I mean, I don't waste it because I can cut it up and sell it as odd bits, or I can use it to design on and work around that spot. But then I got to re-dye the piece if it's for a wholesale, because that's where it gets really complicated, because I do sell wholesale and I do retail. With retail stuff, I can cut it up, play with it, and I can force it to work. But wholesale, they want a whole yard of it. And they're, you know, they don't want to work around hot spot. I mean, I wouldn't want to, and that, not going to force it on them, but it can be hard because it's expensive. Linen is expensive. Wool, the velvet is not as much, but it's gone up quite a bit too. But yeah, you have to play it. That's why I think that's another reason why the Etsy shop and retail sort of started happening with me too, is I was had the stuff that I couldn't sell as a wholesale, but I didn't need all of it. So I just started selling to the retail market.
Yeah. Yeah. That, are you seeing the quality of linen? Is it holding up as they scramble to mm-hmm. make it, or is it deteriorating?
It's deteriorating. I probably will get slapped somehow. Someone will say something nasty for me about saying that, but no, it has.
Oh.
It's not the same. And it's not taking the dye as well as it should either.
Oh. So in their effort to meet the demand, corners
that
get...
and so, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to overstate.
Yeah, corners are apparently getting cut then.
I'm not trying to slam them or anything. I don't know if they're trying to extend the flax. I mean, it could be where, I don't know the whole story. I haven't talked to anyone. But I can imagine that maybe they don't have as much flax as they have had. Maybe people couldn't plant the plants. I mean, I don't know the whole story, but I know that it's not the same quality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no slam against them. I know they're trying to do the best they can with what they have, but it's not the same.
Well, yeah, that's the trouble with any with this situation all the way along, is the entire supply chain is fighting to meet demand with not as many workers, or like you said, enough flax didn't get planted. You know, maybe they're being forced to use flax they wouldn't normally use. You really can't fault anyone. Because you know, you got customers who want linen, and all right, well, I'll deliver the best linen I can with what I have. And, if it's not as good as I would normally do, well, I can't get that material, or I can't get enough of it. And, you have to be sympathetic. Everybody, you know, generally people want to produce good products. So, it's not like people want intentionally set out to produce junk. They want good product out there, and, It's just tough. It's really difficult for everyone. And then it trickles down and all the way down to the hobbyist. And then, you know, they gotta pretty much take what's available. And it's, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm a big proponent. Like, I'm on a lot of boards. A lot of people don't know, like I said, cause I've got so many company names and I do so many things. A lot of people don't know who I am. And I try to be incognito cause you can, I just don't like people knowing who I am. I mean, it's not a, I just like being me. But anyway, I fight for everyone because there's been so many comments on, you know, us small dyers, like some of the threads aren't staying consistent. Some of the linens aren't, we can't keep up. And it's like, guys, you don't understand. A lot of the, some of the thread companies have had to change the base color that they over dye on and adjust it because the other, they can't get that anymore. Or it's been so many months that they can't get it because their supplier can't get it. And
right. Right.
People don't believe you. I mean, they think, I mean, unless you do this, you don't understand it. You just don't understand how long it takes.
Right. And I think I've heard even hear someone say, well, the pandemic is over. And I'm like, no. And there's supply chain. I mean, it's just this huge supply chain issue that you can't, you guys, they don't understand that if it goes all the way back to the flax, let's say that they were having a bad year weather-wise. I mean, I live in farm country. You have bad corn year, you know, you have a bad year, you know. But what do they do if they have a bad flax year? I don't think
that's true.
Made all over the place. It's not made. I mean, I don't think we grow flax here in the United States.
We do not. We do not. I think they were growing some in China. I know you could get some linen from China and from maybe possibly South America. I may be speaking out of turn. I never bought from any of those, but I don't think they do it anymore. It's mostly from Germany and parts of Europe. They're the only places that really grow it. Also, the other problem is a lot of these places are small, family-owned companies. Also, in Europe, you're not allowed to run in the red, is it? That you can't go into bankruptcy and still, you have to be making money or they will close you down. So we've lost some businesses. From what I understand, it's like, I'm not trying to out another company, but there's two companies in the United States that put their threads on spools, and the spool companies either have gone out of business or can't make the spools at the moment, and they don't have a way of getting their product out. And people go, oh, we'll just go buy spools somewhere else. Well, there's only some, only like one company or so that can make the spools.
Right.
So people don't understand that. There isn't someone else stepping up doing it. We're in a very small market. The linen that we buy is not made. I mean, we think we're a huge industry. People here think we are, but really the linen we're buying is made by companies that are making it for upholstery. And they used to use it in the food market, like straining for cheese and making some, using it to make foods and stuff. And so we're a very small niche for them. They make upholstery fabric, and linen's not their big maker. So we have to commit to buying these huge runs just to get into the looms for them. So people don't get that either. They think that they're just churning out linen all the time, and we're thrown in there with them making their other fabrics. And we are hinged on the upholstery fabric companies too. So that's why our colors are getting less and less as manufactured colors, because there isn't a call for them, because people aren't using that type of fabric in other industries as much. It's the same with wool. Wool is not used. Synthetics and blends are used more than just pure wool, so it's harder and harder for us to get it. It's and that's why it's going up in expense too. And velvet's the same thing. It's not used by designers, so there's not a huge need to manufacture it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much to it that we just don't realize, because we just want to buy a fat quarter of linen and go stitch on it. But yeah, it's not that simple. Not that simple. No. Do you see people wanting higher thread counts in their linen these days?
Oh my God.
Yeah, really? Okay.
Yes. There's two weird trends that are happening. Because 32 used to be the go-to size. It's now 36, 40, and 46. Some people go to 50, but I don't mess with that. And then there's all these, there's a resurgent of stitchers, and they're into Aida. And Aida has made a huge comeback. And I dye a lot on Aida. A lot of people won't. It takes differently because it's cotton. You can get a linen Aida, but yeah. A majority of people are going to a higher count.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's interesting that going back and there's people doing Aida. I wonder if it's, you know, eyesight, you know, people who, because I run into people who say, oh, I used to stitch, but I can't see. And I'm like, well, I can help you with that.
It's a mixture of both. I'm getting both answers. I'm getting people that are like, because that's how long ago they stitched, and they're back on it and they're comfortable with it. And some of them are moving over to linen. And I on my Etsy, I talk with them. I've even done FaceTime conversations with people and taught them how to work on linen, moving from Aida to linen. And but I'm also getting the people that are talking, shops are saying they're selling more. And I'm also getting customers that are saying they can't see it. They don't want to deal with it. They're liking some of the looks of it. But then I talk to them because a lot of people don't realize that it's the distance in your glasses. You can have your glasses, if you go in with your needlework and tell your eye doctor that you stitch at this distance, and they change the distance. And even if you're able to add magnification into your glasses, you can see. So a lot of people, it's not, you know, peeps just don't work because they're at a book distance. You really need to work with your eye doctor and work with the distance. And a lot of doctors won't do it, but if you can find one that will, you can take your stuff in and they'll measure where you hold your stuff. And so you need a whole separate pair of stitching glasses.
There's a business for optometrists, yeah, stitching glasses.
Stitching glasses, yes.
Yeah, and yeah, because I asked mine, and he was like, no. I started to ask him. He goes, no, I won't do it. And I'm like, well, thanks. I'm like, but I do a lot of stitching.
He just shut you down? He wouldn't even try? Wow.
He did not even hear me out.
No, a lot won't. And I had to, that's why I drive 20 miles over to, which in Atlanta is nothing, but I go to this one place because they do it. Because there's a lot of eye doctors that won't do it.
You'd think they'd, well, yeah, I think a lot of things. Never mind. What's happening with your finishing? Do you do a lot of finishing? Has there been an increased demand for that?
I saw an increased demand last year. This year, I only have a few people I do it for.
Okay.
I picked up a lot of new customers last year, but they probably got back on their rotation. I don't promote it as much because it does take a while, and I have special people that I do it for. Mostly, I used to teach in town. I really enjoyed that because I had people that would walk in off the street from the needlepoint, in the needlepoint store, and I taught mostly needlepoint finishing in there, and I would learn from my customers because I didn't know what they were bringing in when they would come in, and so right on the fly, we would finish their product in 3 to 3.5 hours. They would usually leave being able to just do the minor touch-ups on it, and I enjoyed doing that, and then I decided it just was too much to add it to leave the house and go do it because the dyeing and other things have gotten so busy that I don't do that as much anymore. So, but I did, like I said, last year I picked up a lot because people missed the Christmas deadline. So a lot of people recommended me, and this year not as much, which is good and bad. I mean, I enjoy doing it, but it's It's sort of like my back burner thing I do. And I do have like my regular customers that I do for them. And they know that it can take me a little longer to, throw that in. So I would love to start a business, but living in Atlanta, you can't find people that want to do handwork. So I would have to have more people. Usually finishers have other people that help them with it, and finding people to help me do my business is also holds me back because it's not rocket science. It's very boring, and a lot of people don't like doing that.
So what portion of your work time is dying? Is that the vast majority?
Yes, it's become that. It
Yeah.
really has.
Yeah. Just 'cause the demand is so high.
Yeah. And I'm so behind with getting it to my distributor that I'm ready for them to drive over from Alabama and with them and for Hoffman to come get me. Yeah. Because I keep getting these emails from Rod. Okay, now. Like, okay, I'm working on it, I promise. So yeah, it
Yeah.
really is. And it can be hard because you wake up some days knowing that, you're gonna drop everything you touch. And that's not a day to die because it's timing and measuring. And if you try to force it, it just is, it has to be a Zen moment. It really does.
Boy. Yeah. Challenging. Challenging. Yep. So do you, when you have time to do personal stitching, is it your own? I'm assuming you have some time. Is it your own designs, or do you get other people's work and just mindlessly go after it?
I have several designers that I don't use stitchers because I adjust when I stitch. So I stitch my own stuff and I get sick of stitching my own stuff, believe it or not. I really, but I have about four or five designers that I don't want to change their stuff. Either their designs are so different from mine, I wouldn't change them. The only thing I may change out are colors. And so it's mindless for me to do that. So I do stitch their stuff to relax. I don't get as enough of it as I would like. I do find myself wanting to change it sometimes, and that's when I stop and put it aside. But I like stitching the other designer stuff just to be free because I don't want to. I'm not working at doing it. I'm just following directions. So
Yeah. No, well, that's why I asked, 'cause after you described all the things you're doing in your business world, I would think you'd just need an escape. Yeah.
I used to do, this is a strange, I'll just throw it in. I used to do Uber and Lyft, and it wasn't for the money as much as it would be for, I would get stuck on something or be in my house, and it's like, I need to get out, but I don't like shopping and doing stuff like that. I'm not a normal person or woman like that. So I started Ubering and Lyfting. So my telephone slash directions would tell me where to go, and I didn't have to think about it. And I met some interesting people
I'll bet.
and found out all kinds of things. Like my son, like I, he is wants to do manga and write movies and do graphics. And I found out from one of my customers that you don't turn in resumes to places, you buy tickets to these movie festivals, and the levels of tickets you buy are how you can meet producers and things like that. So we started doing that so he could meet people and network that way and find jobs. And then my daughter is a live sound tech engineer, and I met people in the industry that do music and do that, and got some information that I could pass on to her, and got connections for her. And I just found out just odd things from people that I was able to pass the information on to other people. And it was funny. I would do the morning shift where I would take people to work because I wouldn't do what they call the drunk shift. I didn't like going to downtown, and I would get a lot of repeat customers. And they used to call me the Uber Lyft mom because I always would mom people and give them information and get information. But
Oh, Oh, the Uber Lyft mom. I love that. That's perfect.
Yeah. And after the you know, you couldn't do it during the pandemic and the rules were so strange. And then now a lot of people don't drive into work. I just don't do it. Because it's just, it's not as comfortable. I mean, it's not that I wouldn't feel that safe, but it just doesn't fit into what I want to do now. And I miss it because I used to, like, if I couldn't sleep at night sometimes, like early in the morning, I would just like jump in my car and go take people to work and then start my day. It was interesting. It was like the world would go through your car. I mean, I've done an Airbnb before and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed just meeting people and gleaning from them.
That's so interesting that you would use it. Yeah, it's not the money. It's just get me out and meet people. Yeah, I can see how that would work. Yeah, and you would meet all kinds, no doubt about
You
that.
meet all kind, yeah, I can, I could, that could be a whole nother segment story. Things that have happened in my car.
We'll save that. We'll save that.
Yes, we
We'll save
will.
that for another time. Yeah. So, and here, the other thing I wanted to ask about was you have those, the antique like frogs that you sell on your Etsy site. Is that because you collected a whole bunch and decided it was time to move on from having them, or do you like the hunt for them?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me, and I tried to remember how it started, and I can't remember how it started. I think I upcycle things. I like recreating things and making folk art and doing things like that. And I threw them on the Etsy, and someone, I think I saw one, and I think what happened was I got a container. One of those milk glass containers, those vases that had the little scalloped edges on them. And I didn't know what to do with it. And someone told me that people put scissors on them and then they have these frogs. And down here in the South, we can't find them like you can up north. So I figured out what they were called and looked them up. And I get a lot of mine off of eBay. I do find them in some, excuse me, some stores and things like that. Thrift stores, but I put a few of them together and then I started enjoy finding unique containers with and put frogs in them. And I used to just only sell them when I would do markets, but then I have boxes of them and I'm not kidding. So I started selling them on Etsy and they've taken off. So yeah.
Yeah, I just I because I found them and occasionally, and I remember I was looking for one, and my friend said, "Please do not buy that. I have a collection of them." And that's what made me ask, wonder if you were like her, and she because she had this collection that she was trying to downsize. Take these,
No,
Beth.
it would be interesting. I mean, I've met people that do, and I actually just did the prim stitchers and taught for them and vendored. And one of the ladies there is downsizing stuff, and we had to readjust. That was like the class that would never happen because we had to redo the reschedule it because of the pandemic. And finally, it was like, oh God, we're going to finally do it. And somewhere in the middle of the rescheduling, one of the participants had contacted me and said, oh, I have this collection I'm going to downsize and I've got things. And I forgot the conversation. So sight unseen, I bought five boxes of containers and frogs from her and spent, I know I spent, I had a
You.
friend of mine that
I love
came
you, Liz.
down over Thanksgiving and we spent 2 days listing what we could of them. And I still have three boxes of frogs that I've got to find containers for. But yeah, it was sort of, I had no idea what I was going to get. So yeah. But
Oh,
how fun.
that's so wild because I saw not on your site but somewhere else a frog thing the other day, and I thought, boy, I bet those are getting hard to come by anymore because people use them for scissors and other things. No, all right, now we know where we can get a lot of them.
I know you
So.
can come down here and get them out of my studio. They are going up in price. I've no, I mean, well, everything is, but people now know what they have. So
Yeah.
you have to be careful. You have to really watch. And the shipping's what's really killing a lot of it. And that's why it's hard on Etsy because, you know, free shipping after a certain amount of money, and that when you sell so much on there, that's what happens. So you have to add that, you know, you have to offset it, or you're just giving it away if you don't. So, and I package my stuff. So it wait, I mean, I bubble wrap it and I put support system in the box and stuff like that. I mean, I've been surprised. I've even had people when I've bought them, send it to me in a bubble envelope with nothing on it. And most of them arrive unchipped and everything, but you're like, do you not understand what they do to the mail?
Yeah,
You
no
not
kidding.
the road. Oh.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth, this has been a real treat. Thanks for making the time to do this. We've enjoyed it.
Thank you, and
Thanks to everyone for listening.